Chapter 2. Upon the deck, wraps his cloak about his knees, draws his white cotton nightcap tight over his head and ears, and, as the smoke of his cigar rises calmly upwards to the deep sky and the cheerful twinkling stars, he feels himself exquisitely happy, and thinks of thee, my Juliana. Why people, because they are in a steamboat, should get up so deucedly early I cannot understand. Gentlemen have been walking over my legs ever since 3 o'clock this morning, and, no doubt, have been indulging in personalities which I hate, regarding my appearance and manner of sleeping, lying, snoring. Let the wax laugh on. But a far pleasanter occupation is to sleep until breakfast time, or near it. The tea, and ham and eggs, which, with a beefsteak or two, and 3 or 4 rounds of toast, form the component parts of the above-named elegant meal, are taken in the River Scheldt. Little neat, plump-looking churches and villages are rising here and there among tufts of trees and pastures that are wonderfully green. To the right, as the guidebook says, is Walcheren, and on the left Katzen, memorable for the English expedition of 1809 when Lord Chatham, Sir Walter Manny, and Henry Earl of Derby, at the head of the English, gained a great victory over the Flemish mercenaries in the pay of Philip of Valois. The cloth-yard shafts of the English archers did great execution. Flushing was taken, and Lord Chatham returned to England, where he distinguished himself greatly in the debates on the American War, which he called the brightest jewel of the British crown. You see, my love, that, though an artist by profession, my education has by no means been neglected. And what, indeed, would be the pleasure of travel, unless these charming historical recollections were brought to bear upon it? Antwerp. As many hundreds of thousands of English visit this city, I have met at least 100 of them in this half-hour walking the streets, guidebook in hand, and as the ubiquitous Murray has already depicted the place, there is no need to enter into a long description of it, its neatness, its beauty, and its stiff antique splendor. The tall pale houses have many of them crimped gables that look like Queen Elizabeth's ruffs. There are as many people in the streets as in London at 3 o'clock in the morning. The market women wear bonnets of a flower pot shape, and have shining brazen milk pots, which are delightful to the eyes of a painter. Along the quays of the Lazy Scheldt are innumerable good-natured groups of beer drinkers. Small beer is the most good-natured drink in the world. Along the barriers outside of the town, and by the glistening canals, are more beer shops and more beer drinkers. The city is defended by the queerest fat military. The chief traffic is between the hotels and the railroad. The hotels give wonderful good dinners, and especially at the Grand Laborer may be mentioned a peculiar tart, which is the best of all tarts that ever a man ate since he was 10 years old. A moonlight walk is delightful. At 10 o'clock the whole city is quiet, and so little change does it seem to be that you may walk back 300 years into time and fancy yourself a majestical Spaniard, or an oppressed and patriotic Dutchman at your leisure. You enter the inn, and the old Quentin Durward courtyard, on which the old towers look down. There is a sound of singing at midnight. Is it Don Sombrero, who is singing an Andalusian seguidilla under the window of the Flemish burgomaster's daughter? Ah, no, it is a fat Englishman in a zephyr coat. He is drinking cold gin and water in the moonlight, and warbling softly, "Ix my dolly, pals, fake away, and ix my dolly, pals, fake away." *** in 1844. I wish the good people would knock off the top part of Antwerp Cathedral spire. Nothing can be more gracious and elegant than the lines of the first two compartments. But near the top there bulges out a little round, ugly vulgar Dutch monstrosity for which the architects have, no doubt, a name which offends the eye cruelly. Take the Apollo, and set upon him a bob wig and a little cocked hat. Imagine, God save the king ending with a jig. fancy a polonaise, or procession of slim, stately, elegant court beauties, headed by a buffoon dancing a hornpipe. Marshal Gerard should have discharged a bombshell at that abomination, and have given the noble steeple a chance to be finished in the grand style of the early 15th century, in which it was begun. This style of criticism is base and mean, and quite contrary to the orders of the immortal Guy, who was only for allowing the eye to recognize the beauties of a great work, but would have its defects passed over. It is an unhappy, luckless organization which will be perpetually fault-finding, and in the midst of a grand concert of music will persist only in hearing that unfortunate fiddle out of tune. Within except where the Rococo architects have introduced their ornaments, here is the fiddle out of tune again. The cathedral is noble. A rich, tender sunshine is streaming in through the windows, and gilding the stately edifice with the purest light. The admirable stained glass windows are not too brilliant in their colors. The organ is playing a rich, solemn music. Some 200 of people are listening to the service, and there is scarce one of the women kneeling on her chair, enveloped in her full majestic black drapery, that is not a fine study for a painter. These large black mantles of heavy silk brought over the heads of the women, and covering their persons, fall into such fine folds of drapery, that they cannot help being picturesque and noble. See, kneeling by the side of two of those fine devout-looking figures, is a lady in a little twiddling Parisian hat and feather, in a little lace mantlet, in a tight gown and a bustle. She is almost as monstrous as yonder figure of the Virgin, in a hoop, and with a huge crown and a ball and a scepter, and a bambino dressed in a little hoop, and in a little crown, round which are clustered flowers and pots of orange trees, and before which many of the faithful are at prayer. Gentle clouds of incense come wafting through the vast edifice, and in the lulls of the music you hear the faint chant of the priest, and the silver tinkle of the bell. Six Englishmen, with the commissionaires, and the Urres guidebooks in their hands, are looking at the Ascent from the cross. Of this picture the guidebook gives you orders how to judge. If it is the end of religious painting, to express the religious sentiment, 100 of inferior pictures must rank before Rubens. Who was ever piously affected by any picture of the master? He can depict a livid thief writhing upon the cross, sometimes a blonde Magdalene weeping below it, but it is a Magdalene a very short time indeed after her repentance. Her yellow brocades and flaring satins are still those which she wore when she was of the world. Her body has not yet lost the marks of the feasting and voluptuousness in which she used to indulge, according to the legend. Not one of the Rubens pictures among all the scores that decorate chapels and churches here has the least tendency to purify, to touch the affections, or to awaken the feelings of religious respect and wonder. The Ascent from the cross is vast, gloomy, and awful, but the awe inspired by it is, as I take it, altogether material. He might have painted a picture of any criminal broken on the wheel, and the sensation inspired by it would have been precisely similar. Nor in a religious picture do you want the savoir faire of the master to be always protruding itself. It detracts from the feeling of reverence, just as the thumping of cushion and the spouting of tawdry oratory does from a sermon. Meek religion disappears, shouldered out of the desk by the pompous, stalwart, big-chested, fresh-colored, bushy-whiskered pulpiteer. Rubens' piety has always struck us as of this sort. If he takes a pious subject, it is to show you in what a fine way he, Peter Paul Rubens, can treat it. He never seems to doubt but that he is doing it a great honor. His Ascent from the cross, and its accompanying wings and cover, are a set of puns upon the word Christopher, of which the taste is more odious than that of the hooped petticoated virgin yonder, with her artificial flowers, and her rings and brooches. The people who made an offering of that hooped petticoat did their best, at any rate, they knew no better. There is humility in that simple, quaint present, trustfulness and kind intention. Looking about at other altars, you see, much to the horror of pious Protestants, all sorts of queer little emblems hanging up under little pyramids of penny candles that are sputtering and flaring there. Here you have a silver arm, or a little gold toe, or a wax leg, or a gilt eye, signifying and commemorating cures that have been performed by the supposed intercession of the saint over whose chapel they hang. Well, although they are abominable superstitions, yet these queer little offerings seem to me to be a great deal more pious than Rubens' big pictures. Just as is the widow with her poor little mite compared to the swelling Pharisee who flings his purse of gold into the plate. A couple of days of Rubens, and his church pictures makes one thoroughly and entirely sick of him. His very genius and splendor pales upon one, even taking the pictures as worldly pictures. One grows weary of being perpetually feasted with this rich, coarse, steaming food. Considering them as church pictures, I don't want to go to church to hear, however splendid, an organ play the British Grenadiers. The Antwerpians have set up a clumsy bronze statue of their divinity in a square of the town. And those who have not enough of Rubens in the churches may study him, and indeed to much greater advantage, in a good, well-lighted museum. Here, there is one picture, a dying saint taking the communion, a large piece 10 or 11 feet high, and painted in an incredibly short space of time, which is extremely curious indeed for the painter's study. The picture is scarcely more than an immense magnificent sketch. But it tells the secret of the artist's manner, which, in the midst of its dash and splendor, is curiously methodical. Where the shadows are warm, the lights are cold, and vice versa, and the picture has been so rapidly painted that the tints lie raw by the side of one another, the artist not having taken the trouble to blend them. There are two exquisite Van Dycks, whatever Sir Joshua may say of them, and in which the very management of the gray tones which the president abuses forms the principal excellence and charm. Why, after all, are we not to have our opinion? Sir Joshua is not the Pope. The color of one of those Van Dycks is as fine Paul Veronese, and the sentiment beautifully tender and graceful. I saw, too, an exhibition of the modern Belgian artists, 1843, the remembrance of whose pictures after a month's absence has almost entirely vanished. Whopper's hand, as I thought, seemed to have grown old and feeble, Verbeekhoven's cattle pieces are almost as good as Paul Poeter's, and Kaiser has dwindled down into namby-pamby prettiness. Pitiful to see in the gallant young painter who astonished the Louvre artists 10 years ago by a hand almost as dashing and ready as that of Rubens himself. There were besides many caricatures of the new German school, which are in themselves caricatures of the masters before Raphael. An instance of honesty may be mentioned here with applause. The writer lost a pocketbook containing a passport and a couple of modest £10 notes. The person who found the portfolio ingeniously put it into the box of the post office, and it was faithfully restored to the owner, but somehow the two £10 notes were absent. It was, however, a great comfort to get the passport and the pocketbook, which must be worth about 9 pence. Brussels. It was night when we arrived by the railroad from Antwerp at Brussels. The route is very pretty and interesting, and the flat countries through which the road passes in the highest state of peaceful, smiling cultivation. The fields by the roadside are enclosed by hedges as in England. The harvest was in part down, and an English country gentleman who was of our party pronounced the crops to be as fine as any he had ever seen. Of this matter a Cockney cannot judge accurately, but any man can see with what extraordinary neatness and care all these little plots of ground are tilled, and admire the richness and brilliancy of the vegetation. Outside of the moat of Antwerp, and at every village by which we passed, it was pleasant to see the happy congregations of well-clad people that basked in the evening sunshine, and soberly smoked their pipes, and drank their Flemish beer. Men who love this drink must, as I fancy, have something essentially peaceful in their composition, and must be more easily satisfied than folks on our side of the water. The excitement of Flemish beer is, indeed, not great. I have tried both the white beer and the brown. They are both of the kind which schoolboys denominate swipes, very sour and thin to the taste, but served, to be sure, in quaint Flemish jugs that do not seem to have changed their form since the days of Rubens, and must please the lovers of antiquarian knick-knacks. Numbers of comfortable-looking women and children sat beside the head of the family upon the tavern benches, and it was amusing to see one little fellow of 8 years old smoking, with much gravity, his father's cigar. How the worship of the sacred plant of tobacco has spread through all Europe! I am sure that the persons who cry out against the use of it are guilty of superstition and unreason, and that it would be a proper and easy task for scientific persons to write an encomium upon the weed. In solitude it is the pleasantest companion possible, and in company never to drop. To a student it suggests all sorts of agreeable thoughts, it refreshes the brain when weary, and every sedentary cigar smoker will tell you how much good he has had from it, and how he has been able to return to his labor after a quarter of an hour's mild interval of the delightful leaf of Havana. Drinking has gone from among us since smoking came in. It is a wicked error to say that smokers are drunkards. Drink they do, but of gentle diluents mostly, for fierce stimulants of wine or strong liquors are abhorrent to the real lover of the Indian weed. Ah, my Juliana, join not in the vulgar cry that is raised against us. Cigars and cool drinks beget quiet conversations, good humor, meditation. Not hot blood such as mounts into the head of drinkers of apoplectic port or dangerous claret. Are we not more moral and reasonable than our forefathers? Indeed, I think so somewhat. And many improvements of social life and converse must date with the introduction of the pipe. We were a dozen tobacco consumers in the wagon of the train that brought us from Antwerp, nor did the women of the party, sensible women, make a single objection to the fumigation. But enough of this. Only let me add, in conclusion, that an excellent Israelitish gentleman, Mr. Hartog of Antwerp, supplies cigars for a penny apiece, such as are not to be procured in London for four times the sum. Through smiling cornfields, then, and by little woods from which rose here and there the quaint peak towers of some old-fashioned chateau, our train went smoking along at 30 miles an hour. We caught a glimpse of Mechlin steeple, at first dark against the sunset, and afterwards bright as we came to the other side of it, and admired long glistening canals or moats that surrounded the queer old town, and were lighted up in that wonderful way which the sun only understands, and not even Mr. Turner, with all his vermilion and gamboge, can put down on canvas. The verdure was everywhere astonishing, and we fancied we saw many golden kites as we passed by these quiet pastures. Steam engines and their accompaniments, blazing forges, gaunt manufactories, with numberless windows and long black chimneys, of course take away from the romance of the place, but, as we whirled into Brussels, even these engines had a fine appearance. Three or four of the snorting, galloping monsters had just finished their journey, and there was a quantity of flaming ashes lying under the brazen bellies of each that looked properly lurid and demoniacal. The men at the station came out with flaming torches, awful-looking fellows indeed. Presently the different baggage was handed out, and in the very worst vehicle I ever entered, and at the very slowest pace, we were borne to the Hôtel de Suède, from which house of entertainment this letter is written. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.